Good day, and thank you for joining our FDA Center for Drug Evaluation and Research Small Business and Industry Assistance, also known as CDER-SBI webinar series. CDER-SBI's webinars focus on specific topics and provide an opportunity for small business and industry entities to learn more about the FDA and basic drug regulations. Today's topic is the draft guidance for industry on safety assessment for IND safety reporting. This webinar will provide recommendations for how sponsors of investigational new drug applications, INDs, can identify and evaluate important safety information that must be submitted to FDA, and all participating investigators under the IND safety reporting regulations at 21 CFR 312.332. Before we introduce the speaker, we would like to cover some logistics. Slides from today's presentation are posted at fda.gov/CDERSBIA, that is CDERSBIA, under Workshops and Webinars. The presentation is being recorded and will be posted in its entirety within 7 days. There is no call in number for this presentation. Audio is via Adobe Connect only. We also wish to remind you that the attendance to this live webinar can be used towards one CE for your Regulatory Affairs Certificate RAC recertification. All attendees will be sent a survey link post-event. We encourage you to complete the survey and provide us with your valuable feedback. If you wish to obtain a certificate of attendance to use in support of your RAC CE, please complete the required details in the survey. The survey will close 2 weeks after issue date. Our speaker today is Dr. Robert Temple. Dr. Robert Temple serves as CDER's Deputy Center Director for Clinical Science and also Acting Deputy Director of the Office of Drug Evaluation 1, ODE 1. In 1972, he joined CDER as a Review Medical Officer in the Division of Metabolic and Endocrine Drug Products. He later moved into the position of Director of the Division of Cardiorenal Drug Products. In his current position, Dr. Temple oversees ODE-1, which is responsible for the regulation of cardiorenal, neuropharmacologic, and psychopharmacologic drug products. Dr. Temple has a long-standing interest in the design and conduct of clinical trials. He has written extensively on this subject, especially on choice of control group in clinical trials, evaluation of active control trials, trials to evaluate dose response, and trials using enrichment designs. Before our speaker begins, I would like to remind you that the entire webinar will run approximately 60 minutes with approximately 15 minutes at the end for questions. We will take your questions from Adobe Connect. If you have a question, we encourage you to type it into the chat box on your screen throughout the webinar. We will address only those questions which pertain to material presented. It's now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Temple.
Good afternoon, everyone, and I'm hoping you enjoy this. We're talking today about guidance and rules we've provided on safety assessment for IND safety reporting. The particular aspect of reporting we're talking about is the so-called 15-day reports, or 7 to 15-day reports, where things that are very important, because they reflect serious potential risks, have to be reported promptly. And how to do that has been a source of interest for a very long time. So, next slide. Oh, sorry, I pushed that. The general areas, not necessarily in the order they'll be discussed, are some background information and comments about some of the previous guidance we've provided in both regulations and a guidance, and matters related to the new guidance, the draft guidance recommendations, which include having a safety assessment committee, which we'll discuss more, how to do the aggregate analyses of safety data that are called for, a discussion of why we believe that the treatment given to someone who has had a possible adverse reaction needs to be unblinded. And a very interesting and difficult question is, what is the threshold for reporting? When do you have enough to report on a particular event? And the need for a safety surveillance plan. So again, as I said, this new interest in these reports began with a new regulation, 21 CFR 312.32, which was primarily about the so-called 15-day reports, and changed the game somewhat to basically suggest that it was not useful to report every serious event that happens, but only those where there's at least some reason to believe the drug had something to do with it. So it describes the sponsor's responsibility for continuously reviewing safety information. After all, if you have to report in 15 days, you can't sit around and wait 3 months before you look at it. And for notifying FDA and all participating investigators of potential serious risks in a report to the IND. It's important to recognize that no one wants to get everything. So the things that have to be reported have to be serious. They have to be unexpected, which we'll talk about more later. Serious, unexpected. They have to be enough of a something to make the reaction suspect, to make the relationship to the drug at least suspected. And we'll talk more about that. You don't just report everything. You only report it if it meets a threshold for being suspected. And it has to be unexpected in the sense that it's not already known. So as the slide says, it describes the sponsor's responsibility for continuously reviewing these materials and then for telling FDA when there's a potential serious risk. It defines a suspected adverse reaction, and we'll talk about what the threshold for being suspected is, which is defined as the presence of a reasonable possibility that the drug caused the adverse event. And it includes examples of the kind of evidence that could suggest a causal relationship in various settings. Okay. In what is somewhat unusual for an actual regulation, it gives a fair amount of details on how to think about adverse reactions. Most regulations don't do that so much. So it gives examples of evidence that could suggest a causal relationship, and they're very different for the different cases. So the first is, even a single occurrence of an event that is uncommon is known to be strongly associated with drug exposures from past experience. And so even a single case of this means it's pretty likely that the drug did it. Things like angioedema, hepatic injury, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, agranulocytosis, those just don't happen in ordinary life, or at least very, very rarely. So that's one thing that would be reported promptly. The next is one or more occurrences. Maybe one doesn't do it, but it's something that really isn't known to be commonly associated with drug exposure, but is really uncommon in the population. And after you get a few of them, you start to wonder, and the classic example of this is tendon rupture with certain kinds of antibiotics and things like that. And then finally, far more common than the above, two, is an aggregate analysis of some event that makes it look like those events occur more frequently in the drug-treated group than in the control group. This could be a study of a gastrointestinal disease, and you see some heart attacks. Well, the population may be at risk for having a heart attack, so having a single heart attack in that study is uninformative. But if there's now 10 in one group and only 2 in the other group, now you have something you might want to report. So it can be events that are not at all related to the disease in question, or it could be events that are part of the disease in question but not the thing you're treating. You know, you have someone with angina and you're treating their chest pain and they get a heart attack. Well, that you expect them to get heart attacks. It's the same disease. But if there's more heart attacks than you expect, then it might be reported. So it's to look closely at events that are part of the syndrome, common, and things like that. It does not, by the way, include study endpoints. That's another matter. We'll get to that later. So having written the regulation, we thought we needed to expand on some of the concepts in the regulation, which is only a page or two. And so we wrote the guidance in 2012 called Safety Reporting Requirements for INDs and Bioequivalent Studies that provided guidance on how to implement the new regulations. its particular focus was on how to do what you had to do under that section, and especially with paying attention to what should not be reported as well as what should be reported. Again, remember, you're only supposed to report events that have all three properties. They have to be serious. That's pretty easy. There's a good definition of serious. They have to be unexpected, which at least initially means it's not in the labeling. We'll get to more details on that. And then they have to be suspected, and that's in some ways the hard part. Now, why did we think we needed a new guidance in addition to the 2012 guidance? Well, we want to make even clearer than we already did what should be reported, what shouldn't be, and we thought more advice on that subject was needed. So the goal of the new guidance is to provide recommendations for how sponsors can identify and evaluate important safety information for expedited IND safety reporting. This is all about mostly about the 15-day reports. So it's very critical that sponsors put themselves in a position to detect and report this kind of information as early as possible. They need some internal system for catching this stuff and evaluating it. But the guidance also recognizes that reporting all serious adverse events, like those that occur in one person, you know, person gets a heart attack, should you report that? As IND safety reports, including those where there's really no ability to attribute causality, the case I just gave, someone has a heart attack, you don't know if the drug did it, how could you? That reporting all of those may obscure important safety information because you drown people in a lot of events that don't matter, and it's quite time-wasting. And we've been reminded of this repeatedly. These reports that a company submits to us are sent to every investigator, really every investigator in every study that's going on in the trial, and to all institutional review boards, who are driven crazy by these because they may have many studies going on and they're being buried in these things, most of which are not very informative. Again, the examples of things that aren't informative are where the adverse event is a consequence of the underlying disease. An angina patient's going to have heart attacks. It doesn't mean the drug did it. And there are lots of things like that. Okay, we also wanted to address in this document concerns that had been raised by sponsors. And the main one is that the new rule requires judgment. And of course, everybody hates that. It's much easier to have a reflex than make a judgment. So the guidance mentions a few things that were potentially troublesome to people. One is that it strongly urges evaluating unblinded data. And the reasons, I'll get into the reasons a little more, but it's sort of obvious that you can't take into account safety concerns if you don't know whether the drug did it or not. But there have always been concerns about whether this could damage trial integrity, and companies are terrified that we will conclude a trial's been inappropriately unblinded, we'll disregard it, won't think it's any good. So their concern is perfectly understandable, but nonetheless, this has to be resolved. There was also some concern, maybe not stated as clearly, but there's some anxiety about not reporting serious events, especially since there's maybe a difference probably not real, as we've discussed it with them, but there may be a difference between what's required in the USA and Europe. Causality assessments under European rules are heavily dependent on the investigator, the local investigator. In our rule, it's very clear that the causality assessment, taking into account what the investigator said, of course, is to be made by the sponsor, by the study sponsor. And there's nervousness when the rules seem to be different in the two places. In any event, what we all agree is that there needs to be a systematic approach to safety surveillance, something within the people doing the trials that enables them to look over all their data in a systematic way. And that's especially important for things that aren't obvious. You know, you have a case of Stevens-Johnson syndrome, anybody knows you can report that. But what do you do with accumulating heart attacks? You know, there are some drugs that have caused increased numbers of heart attacks, so it's possible. You want to catch it early so you can monitor it better and for a variety of reasons. Now, in a certain sense, reporting obvious drug-related events like agranulocytosis, acute liver injury, and so on, that's really pretty easy. What's much harder is to know what to make of a serious adverse event that has a high background rate, like, depending on the age of the population, perhaps, heart attacks, strokes, infections. You know, these things happen to the community, and in a large enough trial, you'll do it. So you need a systematic way to approach the safety surveillance for these kinds of things. And so this all relates to what to do with aggregated data. Well, for one thing, there's a requirement to report cases where an aggregate analysis indicates, or suggests at least, that an event occurs more frequently in the test group than the control group. That's right in the regulations. And of course, that's what you'd want for those things that aren't obvious on their face. Related but similar, there's a requirement to report any clinically important increase in the rate of a serious adverse reaction that was known to occur. So you may have thought the rate of whatever it is, agranulocytosis, was 1 in 1,000, and now you're doing another trial in a different population or whatever, and it's 10 in 1,000. So those kinds of increases need to be reported also. I still consider that unexpected because the rate is larger than you thought it was going to be. But therefore, the guidance recommends that sponsors have a systematic approach to safety surveillance so that they can comply with the IND safety reporting requirements under the regulations, but more generally and in a broader sense, to make sure they're really watching over the patients. That really is the whole one of the main points of the IND process. In fact, that was the original reason there was an IND process. We've now come to regard it as the way we give great advice on how to do trials, but it was originally set up to monitor toxicity, because prior to 1962 or thereabouts, we never knew about the bad things drugs did. So there's a need to periodically review the accumulating safety data across all the studies. You can't just look at one study at a time. And that's for the completed studies and the ongoing studies and bringing into it other sources of pertinent information, such as animal data and so on. The data needs to be looked at in the aggregate, and then there has to be a judgment made about the likelihood that the drug caused any serious adverse events, in which case they become suspected adverse reactions. The usual way you do this is you compare rates in a randomized study, looking at the treated group and the untreated group. But sometimes most of the data is uncontrolled, and so the guidance says that you may compare it with rates in other settings. Now, one of the, in my view, slightly more radical parts of this proposal is the suggestion that companies should develop what we call safety assessment committees. I very strongly wanted to call them SACs, but that apparently competes with other uses of that term. But in any event, safety assessment committees. In fact, some drug companies had such committees going back 25, 30 years, and we were told about them at meetings. But it really is a group, an independent group, that is going to review important safety information of basically concerning serious adverse events or things that might be a precursor to a serious adverse event, and make recommendations to the sponsor regarding whether the information meets the IND safety reporting criteria. And, of course, it will do other things like suggest additional studies and so on. It's supposed to be a group of people who are very smart about these things. They would review all safety information from all trials, including the accumulating serious adverse events that might qualify for IND safety reporting. But they'll basically watch the whole thing. They may even suggest additional tests. There's all kinds of things they could do. The committee would be expected to meet as often as necessary, depending on the kinds of events that are being reported, how many studies are going on, and things like that. And that's a judgment call, and we don't expect it to always be the same. We're very broad in suggesting what the composition could be. It could be entirely external, but it could have both internal and external people. It's sure to be multidisciplinary. For example, in most cases, you'd want someone on that committee to know about liver injury, because that's one of the things drugs do, and so on. So it's quite flexible. The guidance also talks about another concept. Part of the requirements for something you have to report is that the adverse event that you're considering has to be, quote, unexpected. Unexpected has ordinarily been translated as meaning it's not in the label if it's a marketed drug, or in the investigator's brochure if it's an IND drug. But what about something that, but that only refers to things that the drug is known to do. What about something that you can expect to happen in the population? You know, it's a population over 65 with Parkinson's disease. They're going to have heart attacks, strokes. They're going to have all these things. You can anticipate that. You know that's going to happen. But you don't want to report each one of those because you don't know that it has anything to do with the drug, and there's no reason to think it does. So for these anticipated serious adverse events, which basically should be identified at the start, and this is what the guidance says, should be identified at the outset of a study, you're only going to report, you're going to watch over them as they accumulate, and you'll report them if something about them passes your threshold for reporting. And these kinds of things could be known consequences of the condition under investigation. So as I said, you're doing an angina trial, but all of those people have coronary artery disease. I know they're going to have heart attacks. And then sometimes the event is just common in the population. You may be studying headaches, but if the population you're studying is an older population, something we endorse, you're not going to be surprised if they get a wide variety of disease of age-related diseases. Those don't merit a report until and unless the frequency of them becomes larger than you'd expect. Now, these events would almost never meet the criteria for reporting as individual cases because they're not really, as individual cases, unexpected. We know they're going to happen, even though they're not on the label. They're actually anticipated. So these events would be reported in the aggregate if analysis indicates that the events occur more frequently in the drug-treated group than in the control group. But obviously, 10 to 9 doesn't merit reporting. There has to be some sensible sense of when it's unbalanced enough to be reported. And the guidance doesn't tell you exactly how to do that. It says you're supposed to think about it. And that's as precise as we could get. But it doesn't have to achieve nominal statistical significance. The threshold is earlier than that. In any event, sponsors should, if possible, prospectively identify the anticipated events of interest, things that they expect in the population, and should have a plan for monitoring those events specifically, and for not reporting them until and unless there's an apparent imbalance. So what we say about aggregate analyses is there's a requirement to report cases where an aggregate analysis indicates that event occurs more frequently in the test group than the control group. Well, you might ask, what does more frequently mean? And that's, it goes into that, but it doesn't give you a quick and useful and invariably perfect answer. There's also a requirement to report any clinically important increase in the rate of a serious suspected adverse reaction over that listed in the protocol or investigator brochure. So if it's way more than you thought it was going to be, you have to report that. And what the guidance recommends is regular unblinded comparisons of serious adverse event rates across treatment groups for both ongoing and completed trials to detect numerical imbalances. And then the sponsor judgment is needed to determine if the aggregate data meet the reporting criteria. The decision could very well be informed by recommendations from the Safety Assessment Committee and from other external sources. We want everybody to get as much information as they can. Okay, next subject is unblinding safety data. Now remember, when we talk about unblinding safety data, we don't see any reason to unblind those parts of the data that relate to whether the drug was effective or anything like that. It's only the safety data. And we think, and this is probably the most controversial part of it, I guess, or makes people uncomfortable. We don't think a safety report submitted to us is very useful unless we know whether people took the drug before they got this problem. Otherwise, you're terrifying people about something that isn't real, or you're not getting excited enough if it is real. We're not too worried about that. We don't think there are going to be so many of these that a substantial unblinding will take place. Remember, these are serious adverse reactions. So we don't necessarily expect that. And, you know, for certain other things like heart attacks, there could be a threshold. We'll only look if there's at least 10 or something like that. We don't have any trouble with that. But most of the time, there will be single or small numbers of cases, and we plainly need to know whether the person was treated. And the others will be groups of events to allow comparison of event rates. But as I said, only the data related to those events, the description and what drug they were on, be reported. There would be an attempt and effort to scrupulously avoid any look at the effectiveness data. And the way everybody's going to do this is you're only going to unblind a limited fraction of events. The unblinding should cover limited data for those events. You know, you have to do what you have to do, but it should be limited. And it should be done only by a limited number of individuals, the Safety Assessment Committee. And we're familiar with that, as I'm sure everyone knows. Data monitoring committees have to be given data to monitor. Practices vary, but it's not uncommon for someone in the company that's developing the drug to make that analysis for the data monitoring committee. Well, obviously, they can't share it with everybody else. They have to firewall it. So this is relatively familiar territory, and we don't think it's going to do the study harm. But we think it's essential. Now, the reporting threshold question, as I said, is interesting. Where you're talking about a small number of events, agranulocytosis, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, you report them right away. Even one case is determinative, even one case is informative, you now know the drug can do this. That's easy. It's not hard to figure out what the threshold is. What's more difficult is what to do with aggregate data, because it's not like a case of Stevens-Johnson syndrome, which you automatically report. You're only going to report these because they're common in the population if you have some reason to think the drug is doing it. So what are you going to think about in trying to decide whether you've met the threshold? Well, you're going to look at the size of the difference in frequency between the treatment and control group. That's sort of obvious. It might be persuasive if you saw such an increase in multiple trials. That would support the likelihood that it's true. Maybe there's a preclinical finding that suggests that something like that was going to happen. That would light your fire. Evidence of dose response, not commonly seen, but would certainly be a part of a reason to go to believe that you're at the threshold. And of course, once you've reported some of these, it's necessary to periodically reevaluate updated rates of the unblinded events to see whether it's looking worse or has gone away or anything like that. And the guidance calls for all that. There's also an obligation to find relevant follow-up information and submit it as soon as it's available. You know, if there's a case of something and the person eventually dies, that needs to be put in. And then the aggregate data needs to be updated periodically, too, in case it changes or something happens. Now, the guidance strongly urges that there be a safety surveillance plan, a clear plan describing the processes and procedures to assess serious adverse events and figure out whether they are reportable, whether there's anything you should be doing about them, and so on. It should address roles and responsibilities of various parties. It should list, it should enumerate the anticipated serious adverse events. Not going to get them all, probably, but it can get the more common ones from past experience. There's a lot of sources of that kind of information. It should identify previously recognized serious adverse reactions so that their rate can be monitored. It should describe the review processes, the people who are going to do it, whether there's a safety assess committee, and so on. And some effort to give the guiding principles that are going to take place in these reviews. How frequently? Does it depend on the number of patients? Just how are they going to do it? And my last slide is some references where you can find all this stuff. And we're done. With me.
Thank you. This concludes the presentation segment of today's webinar. We will now transition to the question and answer session. If you haven't already entered your questions, please do so at this time so that we may address as many questions as possible. If you have already submitted a question, there is no need to resend.
Okay, here are the first three questions, and we'll look at some more. What's the timeline to submit the results of the aggregate data? Well, as you remember, there's a 15-day report. So the question here is, when does the 15-day start? And it's 15 days after the sponsor determines that the information qualifies for reporting. Again, that's easy with these single cases that are obvious, but it's not as obvious if you're doing repeated analyses of the accumulating data. But 15 days after the determination is when it's supposed to come in. Next question. Please confirm that investigators should receive unblinded data for SUSARs. We don't call them that anymore, but these serious unexpected suspected adverse reactions. As you will unblind the treating site. Well, as I said before, we're not so sure. Well, you will unblind. I'm sorry, I'm not correct. You would unblind the treating site as to what drug the person's on. It won't give them information about how patients are doing. We consider it perfectly acceptable to send investigators the narrative for each case without identifying the name of what treatment the patient's on. That's okay. At some point, obviously, if this becomes important enough to get into the investigator's brochure, people are going to know about it, but they won't know the individual patients. So presumably, my presumption is the individual cases won't go to the patients, but they will be told what the findings are, because that's one of the obligations. If the study has a data monitoring committee, is the safety assessment committee still required or recommended? In general, our view is that these two have two very, very different functions. What data monitoring committees do varies from one to the next. But first of all, they don't usually meet every month or anything like that. They meet much less frequently. They're not even always on site. They may meet by phone. And they may or may not have expertise in particular kinds of adverse reactions. They will not typically have a liver expert on them. So we think that the fundamental practices are very different. The data monitoring committee is looking at the total data, heavily the effectiveness data, but also certain adverse events. that's not nearly like looking at all of the serious adverse events and making judgments and looking at the case reports. So our view is that generally there should be a safety assessment committee that is separate, likely to meet more often, different expertise, and so on. Okay, this is a long, multi-part question. Let me sort of read it and try to answer what I can. Can you please elaborate on composition of safety assessment committees? The guidance mentions that it should not include members directly involved in drug development. How does FDA define directly involved? I don't think the guidance doesn't want people involved in drug development. It doesn't want people involved in a particular trial or maybe of in the particular development of that drug. But I'm not even sure that's absolute either. So we don't try to specify exactly who should be on the committee. We note that it's fine to use people outside, but that if there's an insider who's very knowledgeable about certain kinds of adverse reactions with the class, it might be useful to keep it. The committee really does have to not break the blind in a way that's damaging. It's been our view, expressed repeatedly, that looking at a modest number of people who, say, had a heart attack and knowing what drug they were on will not break the blind in a meaningful way. You know, obviously, if somebody has a view that a particular unblinding is going to be a problem, then they'll really need to get people from outside the company. And that's okay, too. The question goes on multiple times. Does the review of data for aggregate analysis extend all the multiple INDs for a single active moiety? The idea expressed repeatedly is that we want people to look at all the data. Now, you know, obviously, if the populations are wildly different, you're going to have to analyze them separately. You know, if one group's pediatrics, the other's 90-year-olds, you've got to take that into account. So it has to be done intelligently. But the idea was they would be looking at all of the data available on the drug. There was also a question of whether the data they analyze includes post-marketing data for a drug under clinical trial but approved in another country. Clearly, that is part of the assessment that people are supposed to do of serious adverse events. Whether that's going to be combined with the other data or just be part of the discussion is a little hard to say. Probably the latter. Can safety surveillance plan be updated during the course of the trial? Yes. Will that involve a protocol update and approval from FDA? We don't approve IND matters. We refuse to object to them is what we do. So if there's a change and we have no trouble with it, it can just be implemented. And I don't know if everybody knows this, but IND changes in protocol or anything else can be have to be reported the day they're done. We don't need to have 15 days to review it. If we're worried about something, we'll let you know and say wait. Another question, please clarify the data that SAC should be unblinded to and routinely assess. Is it all SAEs? Well, I think the idea was that, remember, for the individual cases that speak for themselves, it's very easy. If you wanted somebody to evaluate it and you had the SAC doing it, they can just see all the data and won't really unblind anything. What's potentially more worrisome is things that are relatively common in the population. Just to continue my example, this is heart attacks in an angina study. Well, you know, there's not going to be a lot of heart attacks, but there'll be enough so that a fair number of people will, in fact, be unblinded. What we think is the critical distinction is between unblinding the adverse event and only the circumstances related to the adverse event, well, conceivably some baseline characteristics, and continuing to hide all of the information related to the person's clinical outcome. That would, you know, knowing what the interim outcome is without planning for it could really distort things. So there's no reason to provide that information. It's only the safety information. And as we said before, you do have to be very careful that you don't have everybody knowing what every person is on. So there has to be, it has to be a firewall. But again, that's not different from what people do with data monitoring committees all the time. So we think it can be managed. Well, Guy, the question is, what is FDA's expectation for implementing these requirements for ongoing studies? Will companies have a deadline to comply? Guidances don't, for the most part, have deadlines, and they're not rules. These are our suggestions for what people are to be moving toward. We know you're not going to set up a safety assessment committee overnight. There's going to be some time to do it, and they have to be thought through, and the processes have to be considered. Companies still do have the obligation to analyze their accumulating safety data and decide whether or not something is reportable as a 15-day report. They already have to do that. What we don't particularly like is that some companies have just continued to send in every serious event, whether it makes any sense, whether it's informative about whether the drug did it or not. We think that's a waste of everybody's time, and sort of gets in the way. You get sort of buried in stuff that's useful. Only a relatively small fraction of serious events like heart attacks and strokes would be candidates for being reported. That would not be the norm, because most drugs don't cause those. Okay, if a study is already ongoing and the sponsor was not unblinding their SUSAR, should we recommend they begin? Yeah, we think that's the right way to find out whether there's anything going on. And without it, you can't. Well, this question is, how do you see the roles of a DSMB versus SAC? Well, I tried to address that a little bit. I mean, a data monitoring committee is a high-level committee that looks at aggregated data. I'm not saying they would never look at individual case reports. They might, and they all behave somewhat differently according to what they want to do. But we see the SAC as much more involved in day-to-day looking at these cases. Remember, an event that's a reasonably likely unexpected adverse event has to be reported in 15 days. There's no real excuse for having it occur in January and not looking at it till March. So we think this committee has to be prepared to look at these things relatively frequently, which is not like most data monitoring committees. Can you clarify how an internal safety assessment committee would remain independent? Well, it's an interesting question. What? It's an interesting question. Look, I mean, what's the normal obligation for reporting adverse reactions? It's the drug company. It's the very people who are developing the drug who have all kinds of feelings, no doubt, about finding something bad, finding something good, and so on. So that's their responsibility. I think a safety assessment committee could, in the same way, be part of the drug company's obligation to monitor these events. A data monitoring committee wants independence. You want them to be completely independent and have no going in, because they're talking about whether the whole study continues. It's a major thing. I'm not saying nobody should ever worry about this, and there's no reason that these committees couldn't have external members or couldn't be entirely external. We have not said that's necessary yet, and at least partly that's because the obligation to report safety issues has always rested with the companies.
Well, one question was, can we expand the role of the DMC instead of creating SAC?
I wouldn't say that's not possible, but remember a couple of things. Data monitoring committees, this has changed somewhat, but at least as originally invented, were about a single trial. They weren't looking at other trials, and, you know, people might be nervous if they were watching over the whole database. So that's a little difficult. And then the way they historically have been set up, they're not that large. They're not necessarily meeting on site. And they certainly don't usually look at the detailed record of an adverse event. Now, if someone with maybe only one trial going on said, I want the same committee to do this, I don't think that's out of the question. They're already unblinded. So I think someone could do that. But I think in most development programs, that's not going to work because the data monitoring committee meets far less frequently and often doesn't have the expertise needed to evaluate these events. Now, they may be pretty good at knowing whether the at determining whether the rates increased by more than a little, and that part of it. But to the extent that the events themselves need a close look, I wouldn't have thought most data monitoring committees are best suited for that. But I wouldn't rule it out. Can you elaborate more on the review of aggregate data, particularly the increase in frequency? Do you commonly see reporting something as expected at a 2% frequency, 3%? I'm not entirely sure I understand that, but there are plenty of adverse events, you know, over the course of a year in a cardiovascular outcome trial that occur at a rate of 2% or 3%. Or other things that happen to old people, infections and things like that. So a 2% rate would not be so unexpected. What we're looking for is whether there's an imbalance, whether it looks as if the treated group has more of these events or materially more or, you know, who knows, than the control group. That's what the threshold for reporting it is. It isn't the absolute rate. These are serious events. If they occurred at a 2% rate and were drug related, you'd be worried. So it's all here whether you can reach a causality conclusion. Is there evidence that it's being increased by the drug? Which trials are recommended to have a safety assessment committee? Does size or phase of the trial matter? I don't think we made a specific recommendation to that effect. It wouldn't seem particularly sensible in a phase one study. Everybody's looking closely at those adverse reactions, and they're often not blinded. By the time you get to a control group, to a trial with a control group, and these events occurring more than hardly ever, then it becomes of interest to have a group watching over them. And again, we strongly encourage this to apply to all the trials that are going on of a drug, not just one. It shouldn't be like a data monitoring committee trial by trial.
This concludes the question and answer segment of today's webinar. CDER SBIA appreciates your participation in our webinar series and hope that you enjoyed today's presentation and found it helpful. We look forward to your presence at our future webinars, which will be advertised on our website at fda.gov/CDER SBIA. We also wish to remind you that the attendance to this live webinar can be used towards 1CE for your regulatory affairs certificate VAC recertification. All attendees will be sent a survey link post-event. We encourage you to complete the survey and provide us with your valuable feedback. If you wish to obtain a certificate of your attendance to use in support of your VAC CE, please complete required details in the survey. The survey will close 2 weeks after issued date. Thank you, Dr. Temple. for being part of this webinar. On behalf of CEDAR Small Business and Industry Assistance, we'd like to thank you for your attendance. See you next time.